All right. We're working like a finely tuned clock right now. All right, that's right. That's what we're up to. We got a packed show, so I'm not going to fool around a whole lot opening it up. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with historian Peter Fritzsche. He's the author of Life and Death in the Third Reich and Iron Wind and Germans into Nazis. And we're going to be talking about how ordinary Germans became supporters of Hitler and the Nazis and were complicit in unspeakable horrors. And we're going to be looking at that in relation to what the hell is going on today, too, right here, right now. All right. Before that, we'll be talking with Rush Holt, CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the world's largest general scientific society, and one of the partners in the March for Science. And we're going to be talking about the importance of this event. However, opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York and member of the advisory board of RefuseFascism.org. And we're going to talk with Andy about this 10 days of resistance, beginning with the March for Science on April 22nd, tomorrow, through May 1st. And these are protests to stop the regime's demonization, attacks, and deportation of immigrants, and basically to mount a whole other, to get things to a whole other place, what's needed, what's necessary. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
For a few weeks now, I want to just jump right into this. For a few weeks now, we've been talking about the 10 days of resistance. And it's been on RevCom. It's been on Refuse Fascism has gotten it out everywhere. And now we're coming right up on it. And Refuse Fascism has called on people to take the streets for 10 days. Give people a picture of what this needs to look like.
Well, what it needs to look like is, well, for one thing, there are these three protests that are called, actually many protests that are called not by Refuse Fascism. There's the March for Science tomorrow all around the country, but really focused in Washington, D.C. And then next Saturday, the March in Defense of the Climate that's happening in Washington, D.C. and also in cities around the country. And then on May 1st, there's diverse activities in different cities protests that are going to be targeting and bringing to light the situation that immigrants face and refugees face, in particular by the actions of the Trump-Pence regime. So in this context, Refuse Fascism has called for these 10 days of struggle to unite with these protests, but more to build contingents at each of these marches that bring forward that single unifying message of our organization, which is to drive out the Trump-Pence regime. And let me just say this, we can go into why the contingents and what makes them important for people to step out and come to. But in the last week, the entire world has been put in extreme peril by this nuclear brinkmanship, by the playing with the idea of nuclear war, and the threats against Korea that come in the wake of dropping the largest non-nuclear weapon on Afghanistan for the really sole purpose of intimidating the entire world. This is the action of a fascist. It's not that previous administrations have not waged war. It's not that, in fact, McCain, Graham, and Hillary Rodham Clinton have called for even more punitive action, more military action. But the fact is, the way that this is being gone at is a different doctrine, including that it is the strongman assertion of U.S. power around the world and intimidation of the entire planet. And it's very connected up with what he's doing domestically. And if you think we can survive this regime and wait for two more years before even a chance at redressing things in Congress, or let alone 4 years to a new presidential regime, you're not paying attention to what's actually going on in the world. So then we can get into the 10 days. But I did want to just highlight that there's an extreme danger now that's being posed to people here and around the world, and you cannot play the ostrich and make believe this isn't happening.
Well, this is really important. And let's get into the 10 days, because it is actually in relation to this. It's sort of, you know, in relation to the overall situation. There's a real need that Refuse Fascism has been pushing at and bringing out the people and fighting for. There's a need for people to actually be out there. And you're talking about 10 days where people are in the streets. It's not like go to a demonstration, come home, go to another demonstration, you know, a few days later or a week later and come home. There's actually something that Refuse Fascism has been arguing for. And it's actually, this isn't when Trump first came into power. It's not the same as what happened then. There's actually been, you know, some, dare say, settling in to a certain extent or sitting back and watching to see what's happening, which makes your introductory remarks even more important. But let's talk about what exactly are you talking about in terms of this 10 days?
Well, look, these 10 days, as I mentioned, the three marches, and then on Monday in New York and possibly in some other cities, I think in Los Angeles, but New York, we're going to be holding a march saying from 1933 to 2017, never again, never again should what happened in the Holocaust happen to any people. And we're at the beginning stages of that. But let's dig into what are we trying to accomplish here. Number one, what we're trying to accomplish is to build up a force of people numbering in the hundreds and thousands now who are determined to see that this entire regime be driven from power and who recognize that such a thing happening, as unprecedented as that would be, although there have been times in history where things similar have happened, such as the driving of the Nixon-Agnew administration from office over a couple of years. But even then, especially then, and especially now, that's only going to happen by masses and masses of people taking to the streets and struggling with a lot of determination and not leaving the streets at some point to be able to actually force the powers that be to drive this regime out of power. So what we're hoping to do and what we're planning to do and what we're working for is these contingents at the Science March, at the Climate March, at May 1st, being expressions of hundreds and thousands of people coming together behind the banner of no, we refuse to accept a fascist America, drive them out of office, drive their regime from power. This is what we want to be bringing forward, that there's a force that's getting organized, it's getting cohered, and that's prepared to lead a struggle and to actually do that and to be acting with and interacting with all the people who are protesting this in various ways, people going to town hall meetings, working, people who think that the way to do this is working for congressional elections, and to go and say to them, look, if you really want to face reality here, and you should and you must, and history demands that we do so, you must see that we can't wait, not just for ourselves, but for the people of the world. And we have to get on this right now. We are facing an emergency, and people need to understand that, and they need to get out there. And these contingents will be part of forging that force, and they will deliver a message to the whole world.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I'm speaking today with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and a member of the advisory board of RefuseFascism.org. And we're talking about 10 days of resistance, beginning with the March for Science on April 22nd through May 1st, protests to stop the regime's demonization, attacks, and deportations of immigrants. This interview was conducted at the beginning of those 10 days, just before the March for Science. Now, tell me this. What are you looking at in relation to this? Here's the thing. Refuse Fascism has actually said that these 10 days are part of there being a big leap in the movement to drive the fascist Trump regime from office. You're starting to get at it, but what do you expect even in terms of going beyond the 10 days? What is the leap that you see making, and then how does this unroll beyond the 10 days?
Well, beyond the 10 days, is we have to build off of this, but we need to actually grow this organization right now. We need to build leadership within the organization. We need to project the message out to people. We need to engage in a big society-wide movement and debate, actually, over what is the problem we face. Look, people should come out to this contingent if they just think this guy's a maniac and he needs to be stopped. You know, if you want to argue, and we will argue, we're having the teach-in. I'm doing a national teach-in on the 27th with George Proshnick, who was on your show, a scholar of fascism, that people can tune into and live stream at refusefascism.org. Look, we think this is fascism, and we can make the case for that. But if you think this is authoritarianism or pre-fascism or something like that, get in these no contingents, because I can't see any defense of saying this is authoritarianism and then saying, well, it's all good, we can take our time here. Look, in an instant, these people can shut down dissent in this country. Just think of what it would be should there be a move towards war, which could happen even, by the way, by an accident. There's a hair trigger situation going on right now in the South China Sea and in North Korea with the United States provocative actions. It's a hair trigger, and things can happen at which point they can shut down, and these people will shut down dissent. As people have been absorbed in a lot of different things, they've passed measure after measure after measure, closing funding to Planned Parenthood. They're starting to potentially deport DACA things. And if you heard Jeff Sessions on the border, where he was essentially using language to talk about immigrants that was similar to how the Nazis talked about Jews in the early days of the Nazi regime and in the years leading right up to that. This is serious business. There is an absolute program, and you had thousands of these fascists showing up, I believe it was thousands, but certainly many hundreds in Berkeley, prepared to do stormtrooper-type battle with the people there who were protesting a speech. So this is a very intense situation, and there needs to be people who are starting to cohere around basta ya, this is enough. We have to put a stop to this thing. And the only way to do that will be by driving them out. And that's only going to happen through mass protests. It's not going to happen any other way. So that's what we're hoping to do. And we want that message blasted around the world. No, we refuse to accept this, and we are preparing to drive out the whole regime. This is important because the whole regime part is important. That's what I'm referring to. It was Mike Pence. It was Mike Pence who was standing there on the Ronald Reagan, which is an aircraft carrier, and then on the DMZ, which is the border between North and South Korea, who was saying things like that the era of strategic patience is over, which is to say that their idea is strategic recklessness and forcible assertion of U.S. power, which can only mean a tremendous amount of misery and horror for people of the whole world.
Mm-hmm. Really important. And part of what I'm thinking about here, too, is that, and I know we're moving up on our time, but I wanted to actually talk about this for a minute here. There is this point, and again, I keep getting fixed on the necessity for things to go way beyond where they are now. And there's a lot of times where you get used to sort of, we have a number of demonstrations, but this is actually calling for, as you're saying, a whole new leap in the ability of people to come forward to take this on in a way that's necessary. We're talking with Peter Fritzsche later about who wrote The Life and Death in the Third Reich in Germans and the Nazis. And you're looking at this thing and all the things that I was, as I was reading this, I'm looking at this and thinking, damn, there's a lot of similarity between what we're living through today and what was going on then. And this question, I kept thinking of that in relation to the real need, that this leap is a real necessity and that there's consequences if the leap isn't made as well.
Yeah, look, you make a very good point. And there's two points that are right there. One, some people say, well, that's kind of extreme. I don't know if it's really fascism. He hasn't done things that happened at the end of the Nazi regime yet. And also drive out the whole regime. I don't know if you could really do that. What mechanism would you do it by? All these kinds of questions. But here's the point. Why would you want to wait till things have gotten to a point where there's attacks on a far more massive scale, and in fact those attacks will absolutely include the suppression and forcible suppression of dissent and the unleashing of these mobs? You don't want to get there. You want to do it now, and the history of fascism in every country where it's come to power is it can become too late. It gets to a point where you can't do it. Secondly, what is going to be required is the kind of struggle that we've not seen in this country in decades, where literally thousands and millions of people are out in the street, out night after night, with a lot of creativity and a lot of determination, where they overcome their fear and the uncertainty and say no and demand that this regime stop. It is the kind of struggle that you saw in the Arab Spring. It's the kind of struggle that we've seen in South Korea more recently, where people were out in the street demanding the regime be overthrown, the president be impeached, which he eventually was, and now she's being indicted. Look, I think your listeners there know that any progressive struggle in this country has only come through the most fierce, determined, and broad struggle. There's no other way to get at what we're trying to do, and that has to change now. You're right, people have been normalized into thinking, well, Trump's just a bumbler. He's doing terrible things, but we'll get our chance in 4 years. You may not, and in fact, it's likely you will not. And that's what people have to wake up to. And that's why these contingents and the other protests we're calling for these 10 days are a big step in getting the kind of force and message out to society, an organized force that is preparing for, and as soon as possible, to get the kind of struggle going that could actually drive this regime from power.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy Z, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And I'm going to get out when right before your teaching happens. I'm going to popularize that. It's all over the place. So people can go to my website and the website for the show and find out that. And I'll announce it again as soon as we get the final information. All right? So.
And people should also go, Michael, to refusefascism.org. They can find out schedules in cities around the country for protests. They can find out about the national news of this organization, as well as it's probably got one of the best aggregations of news about how this regime is moving towards fascism and moving towards consolidating fascism. And it's an excellent place for people to go and get all the information.
All right. Thanks a lot, Andy. Talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Bye. Okay, bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned. We'll be right back. And that was Funhouse, Topsy Turvy 3 from The Big Bang. In the beginning, there was drums, and that's from disc one of that collection. On April 22nd, Earth Day, scientists and others who defend science marched in Washington, D.C., and 600 other locations around the world. Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets in the March for Science. There were even gatherings on Antarctica and at the North Pole. They marched against the attacks on science and the truth, in support of the role of science in government and public policy, and for the very integrity of the scientific process itself. Most major scientific organizations endorsed the march and called on their membership to manifest. As our next guest points out, the March for Science was not the first time that people had marched and protested about issues raised by science, like climate change, but it was the first time that so many felt the need to defend science and evidence-based thinking itself. We hope to be bringing you more on this historic event, but right now I'd like to bring you an interview that I did on the eve of the March for Science with Rush Holt, head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, because of the many important points he raises about the importance of science and the scientific method to everyone. So here's my conversation with Rush Holt. Joining us to talk about this is someone I've been looking forward to talking to. His name is Rush Holt, and he is the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is an American international nonprofit organization with the stated goals of promoting cooperation among scientists, defending scientific freedom, encouraging scientific responsibility, and supporting scientific education and outreach for the betterment of all humanity. Damn, now that's somebody I really want to talk to. Rush, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you, Michael. Thanks for doing this.
Sure. Thank you. Let's jump into this. Your organization and you personally have been out in front of fighting for this march. Why?
Well, first of all, I think you described the organization nicely. We go back 170 years. We're the world's largest general science membership organization. And in our name is Advancement of Science. That's why the organization exists. And we do that in a lot of different ways. And we have programs in science and public policy, science and society, science education, international science, and so forth. And the remarkable thing that grew out of the Women's March and that was picked up on by several young scientists was that at the Women's March, science was breaking out spontaneously. Here was a march that was supposed to be a political protest, and a lot of people were carrying signs that said science is real, whether you believe it or not, and got polio, me neither, then thanks science. And these young scientists said, well, there's a lot of energy out there, a lot of concern about the state of science, the place of science in our society and our government. Let's put on a march. It was very spontaneous. I think they quickly realized they were over their heads, but they responded remarkably well, got thousands and thousands of volunteers and in-kind help, and they've put together something that looks like it's going to be a big deal. So on Saturday, tomorrow, there will be at many places all day long activities ranging from marches to museum open houses to teach-ins to children's science festivals, all in the name of science. And it's not just a celebration, but it is in part kind of an affirmation that science is relevant, useful, exciting, beautiful, but also making the point that science is too important to be downgraded, because a lot of people think that in various ways science has been, well, downgraded or maybe not getting the appreciation that it should. So it's not just a matter of whether the new administration wants to fund science research. It's not just a matter of whether the new administration wants to deny evidence about climate change. It's deeper, broader, and goes back many more years than just the Trump administration, where for quite a while, people have been allowing ideological assertions and opinions to crowd out evidence in public debate and policymaking, for that matter, in private debate, too. Concern that some of the conditions that are necessary for science to thrive, freedom of travel, freedom to collaborate, the free exchange of ideas, freedom to have diverse research teams, all of those things have been either
neglected or denied or challenged. So this energy that has resulted in the March for Science is a reflection of this concern that scientists have and friends of science have. And scientists, actually, I think we're feeling maybe we don't have enough friends and people who recognize just how important this way of thinking is, how important evidence-based thinking is to our public lives and social welfare. And so the march is an effort to pull that out.
Mm-hmm. You're covering a lot of territory, which is really good. And it brings me right back to part of it, which I think is really important for people to understand if this march is actually going to be what it needs to be this weekend. You know, we have to deal with even why should people be out there marching? What is it that dictates that they should march? Why is science important in the world, I guess, is what I'm getting at. It's good for people to understand. It's important for people to understand that.
Well, you know, scientists are asking themselves that question. Why should we march? This is not something scientists do traditionally. A lot of scientists, professionally and personally, have been very reluctant to go into the public square. So this is a big step. If indeed there are, as it now appears, some 100,000 plus or hundreds of thousands of people around the world doing this, it will be a big step. I go back many decades as a scientist and a professor and an administrator, and I've never seen anything like this, where there's a demonstration about the idea of science. It's not a demonstration for or against GMOs or for or against nuclear power or for or against atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons or whatever. This is really about science, about evidence, about the process of answering questions about how the world works and basing policies on our best knowledge of how the world actually works rather than on rigid ideologies or wishful thinking or bald opinions. So just getting out in the public square is a big step. And if it happens, if there are thousands and thousands of scientists out there in the public square, that by itself will amount to something, because it will mean that those scientists will then start thinking about how they communicate with the public, how they let people in on this wonderful way of thinking to determine how things actually are. Science is not just about high technology. It's not a club that is reserved for a few or a few thousand or a few hundred thousand highly trained people. It's really a way of asking questions so they can be answered based on evidence and observation. And then the answers can be verified openly and become established understanding of how things are. It really is the cleverest way of thinking that's been developed in the last 500 years. It's, I would argue, the greatest invention of the last 500 years. And so why be out there in the streets? It's to let people know that this clever way of thinking belongs to them, and they should take full advantage of it, not just the spin-offs in health and communications and transportation and so forth, but in public policy, take full advantage of this evidence-based way of thinking and demand that everybody else, or at least the public leaders, the policymakers, take full advantage of this way of thinking.
I think what you're saying is really important, and I want to talk a little bit about what are some of the major attacks on science today when you look at this. You've talked about a whole lot of things in broad span, but there actually are things that are being fought out that win or lose is going to determine, you know, the fate of the planet, the fate of humanity. What are the major attacks on science today that you see as necessary to take up, to actually speak out for?
There are a number of large issues that are highly politicized. In fact, it's even hard to talk about them, have any meaningful debate, because people retreat to their ideological corners and shout at each other. And this would be climate change and vaccination and GMOs, and the list goes on. Mm-hmm. And what's common to all of them, I think, is that science actually does have something to say about them. It's not just a matter of opinion. And if you want to have good policy on vaccination for kids or burning fossil fuels, let's look at the evidence. And rarely is the evidence perfect. But there's no question that in all of those areas that I mentioned, there is observational evidence that is a whole lot better than opinion. It's a whole lot better than ideological assertion or partisan platform. I just had a partial list there.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, as you point out, they're really important. The climate scientists think that the changes that are occurring in climate because of human activity already are, in fact, very costly in lives and dollars, will become more costly, and that they believe there are some things that can be done about it or might be done about it. So those decisions should be made using the full benefit of science. That's what's at stake, but it's not just one or two issues. Well, as I was saying before, in any public matter, in any public decision, science is your best friend. Now, science doesn't replace personal faith and humane studies and love or poetry, but in all public matters, decisions should be based on the best evidence and not on wishful thinking.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Rush Holt, the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That brings me to something that's very important. I know you've spoken a lot to this. One of the main lines of attack on science comes from what I would call the Christian fascists, these very fundamentalist people who are climate deniers based on their religion, on Adam and Eve, and God said it, so I do it, and all this other stuff, which is not attacking people for having religious beliefs, even though I personally don't. I'm an atheist because I think it corresponds to the reality of the universe. But there's an assault on evolution. And I kept thinking about that as I was reading some of the stuff that you've said. And it's very much related to the wholesale attack on truth and its correspondence with reality. And it's something you've been very upset about, for instance, the assault on epistemology. Let's talk about that and the importance of a scientific epistemology as opposed to policymaking based on ideological assertion.
Sure. Well, I think part of the genius of the founders of this country was that they put in place freedom of religion, really meaning freedom to practice religion and freedom to prevent any particular religion from being imposed on you. So evolution evidently has some strong religious connotations. But on public matters, this country, I think, the founders were pretty clear. On public matters, no religion would be imposed. That says to me that in teaching biology, you should not ignore the central principle of biology, which is evolution. I don't know how you could teach biology without the central organizing principle of it. I think this is a case where on a public matter, we're not talking about personal faith, but on a public matter, evolution has to be taught if you're going to give students a reasonable understanding of how we're going to feed the world through agriculture, how we're going to cure disease through medicine, how we're going to deal with ailments of the human body. You've got to understand evolution to understand our environment, our ecology, ourselves. So I think that's a case where a lot of people, and I don't know that this march is specifically about evolution or specifically about climate change or specifically about vaccination. I'm sure for some of the marchers, for individual marchers, it might be about one of those things. But overall, it's about what science has to bring, what science has to teach us, how valuable and, I would say, accessible science is. Now, on that last point, most people who are not scientists don't think it's accessible. They don't think scientists try very hard to make it accessible to them. But in fact, it is accessible. Anybody can, and I would say anybody should, persistently ask the question, what's the evidence? On whatever issue you're talking about, ask, what's the evidence? So the march will be talking about this powerful tool that is science, and that will help people understand biology and how the Earth works and how humans behave.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think this point about epistemology is extremely important in terms of the development of the world and the people that live in it and are changing the world one way or the other. So this is an extremely important point. I have one more question for you, I think. This whole thing that we've been talking about takes us back to why people should march in the millions and the importance you've spoken to about the importance now of breaking the silence on this.
Well, again, it's not just a celebration. Isn't science wonderful? The reason people are motivated to go to a city or a town where a march is being held is because they think that, yes, it's valuable, yes, it's beautiful, and we've got to stand up for it. Science has given civilization a lot and can give civilization a lot more, can improve the quality of life for people everywhere. But you have to maintain certain conditions for science to thrive. I touched on these earlier. I mean, there's free exchange of ideas, absolutely essential for science to work. Free travel or freedom of travel is part of that. If you can't collaborate with scientists, wherever there is a scientist who has a technique that you would like to use in answering the question that you're studying, you may need to visit her somewhere and learn that technique. You have to have freedom to present your paper at a scientific meeting so that it can be critiqued. That open criticism of science is a central part of science. You have to have, and this is often ignored even by scientists, but you really have to have diverse perspectives, diverse people in the experimental process, in the observational process, so that your results aren't biased from a narrow view. Science is this wonderful system of excluding bias. It's not perfect, but ideally you set up your observations, your experiments, to exclude bias of any kind. Bias imposed by society or a system, bias that comes from your own wishful thinking. And so you need a diverse body to conduct the experiments, to conduct the observations, to evaluate the work. So for science to thrive, you need that. You also need public funding. So some of the march, I imagine, will be focusing on the difficulty in recent decades, actually, to get adequate funding from Congress, or President Trump's administration's new proposed funding levels that are drastically lower than what I would argue are already low funding levels. Just to give a number to that, the federal support for research and development in America is half of what it was in the 1960s, less than half as a fraction of the economy. So clear underinvestment. We're nowhere near diminishing marginal returns on the investment. In other words, we could invest, I would guess, two or maybe three times more, many billions of dollars more, and for each of those dollars spent, get a really good return on the investment economically, but also culturally and medically and so forth. So you can list these conditions that are necessary for science to thrive. And a lot of people are realizing that, and these are going to be people turning out for the march, realizing that we want science to thrive. Everyone should want science to thrive. It brings a lot to civilization. But if we want it to thrive, we're going to have to get out there and stand up for it. Scientists for a long time have taken the attitude, well, we'll let the facts speak for themselves. Well, I guess the facts sometimes need a little help.
Especially in a time like this.
Yes, right.
So I wanted to ask you this, because there's been a lot of assertions and attacks on the march, basically forces arguing that science should avoid getting political. And I've thought a lot about this. The conclusion I've come to is that, look, when there's a massive political assault on science, from the powers that be in particular, that fight, the fight to defend this, is a political act, and we shouldn't shy away from that.
That's right.
Let's talk about that a bit.
Yeah. Those of us who have devoted our careers to doing science, which means asking questions so they can be answered with observational experimental evidence, really believe it's valuable. It's incredibly valuable. You know, it's valuable economically, it's valuable medically, it's valuable in many ways. So if it is being downgraded, disregarded, denied, or deterred, then scientists should speak up. Many scientists have a natural sort of psychological reticence. They don't want to go out in the public square. They'd rather stick to their work. And then partly because of that, I guess, they've developed a justification for why they shouldn't go out in the square. They say, well, we don't want to politicize our science. Well, of course, you do not want to inject bias into your observational experimental work. That's a central practice of science, is to exclude bias. You conduct your experiments in a way that you don't want your instruments or your observers to inject bias. You don't want the people who openly critique your work to do it in a biased way. And there are a number of protections that work pretty well in keeping bias out. So, yes, you do not want to politicize your science. But they make the logical fallacy of saying that the converse of that is true, too. We should not take our science public. Well, that's wrong. It doesn't follow logically from the fact that you should not take partisan politics into your science. It does not follow from that that you should not take your science into the public square. And so, as I said at the beginning, just the fact that there will be a march for science and thousands of scientists will go into the public square means that they're beginning to understand that the prohibition against politicizing your science does not mean that you should not take your science into the public square. If at any time science can shed light on a public issue, or if at any time the practice of science is threatened, well, then you should be in the public square.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Very important. Rush, thank you very much for joining us today. And I also want to ask you, can you tell people your websites and how they can follow up and look into your organization?
Sure. Well, yeah, we're AAAS.org, American Association for the Advancement of Science. We're 100,000 members, and we have a couple hundred societies that are affiliates of AAAS. So our website talks about our programs in science and public policy, where we put PhD-level scientists every year in all branches of the government, about 250 each year, as policy fellows. We have international programs working with other countries and developing countries in science and diplomacy, science education programs. Anyway, you can find a lot of that at AAAS.org. We also link to it from the site, the name forceforscience.org. That's our motto. We want to be the force for science.
That's a damn good motto, Rush. Okay. On that note, though, we're going to have to wrap this up. So thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay.
All right. Take care now. Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Rush Holt. Rush is the head of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. It's an American international nonprofit organization with the stated goal of promoting cooperation among scientists, defending scientific freedom, encouraging scientific responsibility, and supporting scientific education and outreach for the betterment of all humanity. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war.
All right, welcome back. That was Just Like Germany Before the War, and it's from Sonny Meadows and his album Bibles, Guns, and Flags. I am very pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. He's historian Peter Fritsche, who's the author of Life and Death in the Third Reich and Iron Wind, Europe Under Hitler. And one that really knocked me out is Germans into Nazis. And we're talking about how ordinary Germans became supporters of Hitler and the Nazis and complicit in unspeakable horrors. Peter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here, Michael. Thanks.
Yeah, let's jump right into it, man. Let's talk about how Germany became a fascist country ruled by a brutal dictator for more than 10 years. You know, and it's interesting because when people talk about this, we were talking earlier, when people talk about this, there's references to some kind of trickery that enabled all this to happen. But there actually was, he actually did come in, he did actually win an election that people voted in, right?
Well, he did. And there's two extraordinary events that happened in the early 1930s. One is the meteoric, the huge rise of the votes for Hitler between 1930 and 1933. And in the parliamentary system, he topped out at 37%. In the parliamentary system, coming from nowhere, that's a huge number. And that gave him a kind of democratic legitimacy. Moreover, he had a press empire. He had thousands of supporters. He had paramilitary troops. So he had real political power that was visible to almost all Germans by 1932, 1933. But he didn't have everybody. There are millions of socialists, millions of communists, millions of Catholic voters who are not necessarily for Hitler. But within 100 days of the last election in Germany in March 1933, he had completely dismantled democracy, prohibited all political parties, and was riding a wave of popular enthusiasm that historians today are still trying to understand. It was a grassroots movement. It was not funded by big business. It had its ups and downs, and we have to understand why it went up. But this was definitely a democratic movement for pursuing anti-democratic ends in an extremely resolute way.
Well, tell me this, Peter, because this is, you know, one of the things that's really, I think we really have to dig into, because it's sort of, you know, you can see it happening now in a certain sense on another level, but at this point, but it actually has a lot of potential for repetition here. And the whole point of this popular myth around how Nazi rule of Germany was imposed, you know, you've argued in your books that there was actually a reason why Germans became Nazis.
There is a factor of imposition. You did imprison tens of thousands of socialists and communists in 1933, but this is a popular movement. Nazism was popular because it was different. It wasn't a big business party. It was not associated with middle-class interest groups. And it was not associated in the minds of its voters with socialism, communism, and internationalism. It was a third way that combined, in the minds of Nazi voters, social progressive policies that would invite workers back into the nation, but would also think Germany first. That Germany had been humiliated at the Treaty of Versailles and it needed to gather all its national energies in order to act on the international stage and recover economically. So the name of the Nazi party is NSDAP, and that means National Socialist German Workers' Party. That acronym is basically the explanation for why the Nazis were able to profile themselves as a new and different force, especially in economically bad times when people were rejecting what they called the system in droves.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, you know, one of the things that really troubled me is when I'm reading this and I'm studying this stuff and reading your books, and I keep thinking there were, in addition to the people who were like really jumping into the Nazis, you know, and loving the Nazis, others remained supportive but actually didn't like, they liked the new society, but they didn't like the Nazis, and that they sort of managed to find some kind of common ground where they became involved in everything that the Nazis were doing on the ground in the country at the time. And this is, you know, this actually means that they accepted a lot of the stuff that was the build up to, and pretty quickly, the horrendous stuff, the unspeakable stuff that was done by the Nazis.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I make a distinction between Nazis and the Third Reich. And you could love the Third Reich. You could support the National Revolution in 1933, but not necessarily like the Nazis down the block. And in a dictatorship, it's much easier for corrupt, nepotistic local leaders to be quite powerful. And there's no doubt that lots of Germans mistrusted the local brown shirts in the neighborhood. But the big revolution, the National Revolution, as it was called, and the larger project of building a Third Reich, of healing the divisions of German history, of creating a sort of an ethnic consciousness that would make Germany strong again, both inside and outside its borders. That was indeed widely accepted and won increasing assent. Indeed, in 1945, many, many Germans blamed the Nazis for betraying and destroying the Third Reich.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with historian Peter Fritschi. And Peter teaches at the University of Illinois Champaign, and we're talking about basically Hitler, and how the hell you explain how he came about, the people that came up and supported him, and what it means for the world today. And we're going to get into that in just a minute. Peter, tell me this. There's actually, at the same time as you're talking about all this, you know, there was sort of this point about people themselves turning a blind eye at best and sometimes actually justifying a lot of things, horrendous things that the Nazis ended up doing. And this was especially in relation to, I mean, there were all the other people that they took out along the way, but then it was also to Jewish people. There was sort of in a sense, reading your books, I sort of got a sense of like, there's, okay, but people turned a blind eye to this and sometimes even sort of welcomed it as, you know, necessary. Let's talk about that a little.
Germans had a deep desire for a unified and peaceful and affluent community, but they understood, and this is what the Nazis drove home, and this is the myth that they won. Something happened in 1918 when Germany lost the war. It was betrayed from within, and the only way you're going to get your affluent, peaceable ethnic community is to slay the enemies that betrayed you in 1918. Who exactly those enemies were, people differed. It could be communists, it could be the Jews, it could be someone else. But they understood that there had to be eradication, cleansing, violence, in order to reach the desired community imagined in the golden ages of the past, but also then projected onto the future. So there was a willingness to accept ruthlessness, and a willingness to say, well, we can't have Judeo-Christian morality. We have to think as Germans and determine our actions on the basis of what helps Germany. Never before in modern history have people so identified their individuals with the body of the nation. And thinking like that means if you think in terms of betrayal, if you think in terms of a Germany that somehow was lost but could be regained, then you have to move against the betrayers. You have to move against the treason. That was the communists, and that was the Jews. So there was a lot of people were complicit in accepting Nazi violence. I don't think the Germans would have voted for the Holocaust, but they accepted the exclusion of people who had previously been considered German citizens because they had an ethnic-based idea of the German future. And this proceeded extraordinarily quickly, within weeks of when the Nazis won their last elections, people became experts on the Jewish question. How many percent of Jews should be lawyers, should be doctors? Had Jews proven themselves in World War I? However you framed the question, the Jews were different. And that was the first step, the violent exclusion of people who were otherwise your neighbors. Simply by saying Heil Hitler instead of good day, you changed everyday interactions. And so the exclusion of Jews from German life, what's called the Cold Pogrom, happened as much from below as it did from regime proclamations. And it wasn't necessarily at first a brutal violence, but it was the exclusion of your Jewish neighbors from the newly defined German community. And people wanted the Third Reich, and therefore were willing to accept, even if they did think that there were what they called excesses, we're willing to accept them because they thought in ethnic terms, and the Jews were on the other side.
So that was sort of a level of complicity in it, even if they didn't think that that was it. And in your book, Life and Death in the Third Reich, you talk about how a lot of towns, a lot of cities where Jews would disappear people would see them getting on the trains or being trucked out, and then they would rush to get their belongings or, you know, buy their belongings at a local flea market or take over their apartments, which is a level of complicity that is sort of astounding.
It's extraordinary. Now, of course, most people weren't involved in that, but a lot of people were. The fact that Jews were being deported in the fall of 1941 and then again in the spring and summer of 1942 was known. Then, often visibly, the Jews were brought to the train stations via buses or marches or on the streetcars. The apartments were then empty, and auctions were held, and auctions were advertised in the newspapers. And then people, you can read this in the diaries, had to make decisions whether they were going to buy Jewish linens and sleep in them or whether they weren't.
Boy, I tell you.
Let's talk about this, and because we're running up on our time, I have two more questions for you, and I wanted to really get into these. There's some chilling comparisons with the current Trump-Pence regime in the U.S., and anybody who's listening to the show has to have thought that well before I just said that. There's a lot of chilling comparisons, and with regard to immigrants and oppressed nationalities, you know, deportations, arrests, demonization, police terror, et cetera. Let's talk about that.
I ask my students when I teach my Holocaust class, we say, why were people not outraged back then? What outrage is happening to us today that our grandchildren will say, why weren't you outraged? And I have two answers when I'm at, you know, answer specifically. One is our huge prison population, which is four times more than our percentage of people in the world, and the willingness to see illegal immigrants and their families being torn apart. This isn't yet a mass movement, but it is happening here in Illinois. They took the guy who owned the Fiesta Cafe from a downstate restaurant and held him there for 6 weeks till there was so much outcry. But this is happening. You go to El Paso, you go to Nogales, you go to the border towns. People are scared. People are being taken because they're presumed to be illegal. And illegal under the new administration means also probably more criminal. And that means you're assigning evil features to a collective group. This is very dangerous. More dangerous is the idea that somehow we lost America, that America was somewhere in the past was great, but it hasn't been, but it could be again. That means your enemies are small in number, but sinister, and you have to get rid of them. If only had we not done these and these and these things, and that creates internal enemies. And that kind of thinking is extremely dangerous, that there was a wholesome America, and now we're going to get it back. And we're going to get it back by eliminating or getting rid of or somehow undoing the harm between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
And does that mean getting rid of civil rights? Does that mean getting rid of simple empathy when we talk about 11-year-old children or 15-year-old children or 17-year-old children who were perhaps not born in this country but belong in it? It's a whole question of how you define belong.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening.
Yeah.
And if you change the definition of belonging, you're policing that new border.
Wow. Yes, absolutely. Peter, one more question. When I first approached you about coming onto the show, I wrote to you and told you what I wanted to talk about on this first edition, because you are going to be back in about 2 weeks, I think. But I approached you about it and told you what I wanted to talk about. And you wrote back to me, remember this, no one could save Jews in 1942 in front of the gates of Auschwitz. You could only save those who would later, and at that point unknowingly, be murdered if you accepted refugees in 1938. That is poor, non-English speaking, possibly communist refugees. And that, of course, was unacceptable and not done. Let's talk about that.
It was not done, and you can look at the Acts of Congress. So we all would vote. We would all say, no, don't gas people in Auschwitz, of course. The only way you could have saved, you're not saving people from the gates of Auschwitz. You're saving homeless, persecuted, lonely, scared people in 1938 with all of their foibles. They're called refugees, and they could be us.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Syria 10 years ago. I never imagined, could never imagine this. And now, so many millions of the people in that country, perhaps people I met, have no home and no future.
Mm. All right, Peter, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Michael.
Yeah, and talk to you again in about 2 weeks.
Look forward to it.
Me too, man. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with historian Peter Fritschi, and we've been talking about basically the situation in Nazi Germany and the parallels it has to what's going on here today as well. What happened there? How did that actually happen? It's not a mystery. You can actually uncover the causes of all this and look and compare with what's happening in this country today, what's being done. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. Basically, I want to thank everybody here, but I want to also say a couple other things, all right? I want to remind all of you of what Andy Z said about the 10 days of resistance and how important they are. There are still major events coming up.
You can go to refusefascism.org for details, including actions in your area. April 29th is the People's Climate March. There will be actions in D.C. and all over the U.S. And on April 27th, there's going to be a teach-in in New York City, and the name of that teach-in is Fascism in America. Could it happen here? Is it happening here? And that's going to feature George Prochnick, author and New Yorker contributor, Andy Z, who we just heard from, a Refuse Fascism co-initiator, Revolution Books New York City spokesperson, Rita Dentino, executive director of Casa Freehold, and that's part of the National Day Laborers Organizing Network, and Kieran Suckling, a founder and executive director of Center for Biological Diversity. And again, this is going to be held in New York City at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and it'll be live streamed. And you can go to the refusefascism.org Facebook page for the details on all of that, and to watch the video if you missed the live stream itself. And on May 1st, May Day, there are marches and other protests opposing the dehumanization, the roundups, and the deportations of immigrants, following on what Peter Fritsche said, "We need to be outraged against the outrages of these times, to refuse to be good Germans, descending on the homes of the deported to help themselves to their possessions. We must not be complacent or complicit, but do what history and humanity demands of us."
We're going to actually be going out now with a song that I really found was important for today. And I want to thank, before I do that, I want to thank Kiana Williams, my board offer today, Henry Carson, my assistant producer.
We're going to go out now with We Rise, DJ FM's As Above, So Below remix. And it's by Rihanna Giddens.
We Rise. All right, so check this out.